looking at the Shaiva and Tantric traditions today. And I was going to give you an introduction to those. I've got one text that I was going to refer to. So if you could take one across and round, it should have two each. Now, in about the 8th or 9th centuries, there was a different revelation began to arise in early medieval India. And in the 9th century, there was a thinker called Jayanta Bhatta, who was a logician, a Nyaya philosopher. Nyaya is a logician school, who was in prison in Kashmir. And in prison, he wrote this great thick book called The Bouquet of Logic, the Nyaya Manjari. And in this book, Nyaya Manjari, he's starting to think about this new revelation that's coming to town, this new he's worried about the social instability, the social unrest caused by these new texts called tantras. So you had the Veda, as you know, the orthodox text, the orthodox revelation, and the Brahmanical tradition that follows from that. And then you've got this other revelation emerging around the 7th, 8th, 9th centuries called the Revelation of the Tantras. And Jayanta Bhatta is worried about these texts, and in his book, The Bouquet of Logic, he defends the authority, the authenticity of most of the tantric texts. He says, so he's a liberal, in other words, if they don't conflict with the Veda, there's no harm in the tantras. But where they do conflict with the Veda, the king should ban them. And in his, he wrote also wrote a play, Argamadumbra, which Lexisans and translates as Much Ado About Scripture. The Dumbra is a hullabaloo, a lot of fuss about argument of scripture. And in that, he lampoons these tantric ascetics. And he gets the king, Avantivarman, who dies in 902, to ban this sect called the Nilambras, the blue-clad sect. Because they practice their vrata, their observation, which involves sex outside of caste restrictions, wrapped in a blue cloth, and in this play he describes this Brahmin Shankara being shocked by this practice, and then others come along and they're singing songs in the vulgar tongue, in the local dialect, and they're drinking spirituous liquor. And he's very shocked by this. It's a very funny play, actually. It's still funny. And he's shocked by this behaviour. So he tells the king, and the king bans this sect, the Nilambras. And there are other groups there that are worried. Because this sect has been banned. What about us, these other Shaiva groups and Vaishnava groups complaining? And the Shankara in the play, the Brahmin in the play, says, you don't have to worry because your teachings are in accordance with the Veda. So in other words, there's a long way of describing that the tantras were controversial at the time, and a liberal thinker like Jayanta Bhatta accepted them. He couldn't see any problem with new revelations so long as they didn't contradict the old revelations. Now, 100 years later, a Shaiva thinker called the very famous philosopher Abhinavagupta says that the tantric revelation is actually his dates are about 1075 to 1050, something like that. He says that the tantric revelation is higher than the Veda. It's superior to the Veda. It transcends the shankha. It transcends the inhibition that the Veda promotes. the Veda is all about do this, don't do that. And Shankara says the tantras are liberating scriptures that shatter. Abhinavagupta says that, no, that shatters the restriction of the Veda. So you've got this whole spectrum from Jayantabhata, who originally thought they were respectable tantras were okay, to Abhinavagupta, who said actually it's a higher revelation. And Abhinavagupta classifies these texts into various groups. He says there's a general revelation, Samaya, a general revelation that everybody accepts, and then there's a particular revelation that's a higher revelation, which is Vishesha. So you've got these three groups of texts: Veda, Purana, and Tantra. The Vedas, we know what they are. They're the orthodox texts and the Brahmanical tradition that follows from that. And the two philosophies that articulate that orthodox, highly orthodox tradition are the Mimamsa and the Nyaya. The Mimamsa was the atheistic philosophy which said the Veda has no authorship, is eternal, and this injunction. Do this, don't do that. It's all about vidhi, it's all about injunction. So you do what it says in the Veda because it says so in the Veda. The Nyaya is a theistic, logical school of philosophy that Jayantabhata was a member of. So by the 8th or 9th century, you've got these schools in place in Kashmir, say, for example. And then you've got the Puranas. The Puranas, as we've seen last term, were these texts of devotion, really, to particular gods like Shiva, Vishnu, and the goddess. And there are lots of mythological stories, and there's stories of the lineages of kings, from the solar dynasty and the lunar dynasty. We looked at those last term. And this, again, is orthodox worship of these gods. Shiva, Vishnu, and Devi. And also in that group, you've got this group called the Smarta Brahmins and the Smritis, who worship five deities. But there were Puranas to all of these deities. And then about the 7th, 8th century, you get this alternative revelation developing called the Tantra. Now, Abhinavagupta divides the Tantric... Okay, so this is orthodox, orthoprax, orthodox worship of Vishnu, Shiva, and Devi. So you do a puja to them, and then you go to their heaven when you die. So let's take the Shaivas, for example, the orthodox worship of Shiva. Everyone okay so far? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Orthodox worship of Shiva were groups called the Maheshwaras. They were the Rudrabhaktas. They were the orthodox worshippers of Shiva, high class Brahmins who worship Shiva in an orthodox way. And at death, they thought the universe was like an egg, and at death, through worshipping Shiva, they would be reborn into Shiva Loka at the top of the world egg. And this is paralleled by the Vaishnava tradition, where you work Vaikuntha at the top of the world egg in the Vaishnava tradition. So here we have the earth here somewhere in the middle of the Patalas, the hells above, below, and the different realms, different heavens above that. So if you're a Maheshwara and Rudrabhakta, you worship Shiva, and at death you'll be reborn in the Shiva Loka. Now the Tantric revelation, Abhinavagupta says, well, that's all very well, but we want a higher liberation than that, a higher realization. So he distinguished the Maheshwaras from technically the Shaivas. Well, a Shaiva is somebody who follows the teachings of Shiva, the Shiva Shasana. And the Shiva Shasana is revealed through initiation, Diksha. So you've got these two kinds of worship of Shiva. The Orthodox Brahmins and the Maheshwaras who worship Shiva and go to heaven when they die. And the Shaivas who've got initiation, special initiation, which guarantees them a higher liberation at death. And they follow the teachings of Shiva, the Shiva Shasana. Like the Buddhists follow the Bauda Shasana, the teachings of Buddha. And they undertake Diksha.
Tantrism, or Tantra, is that always associated with Shaivism?
No, you get Vaishnava, you get Tantra associated with all of those three, the Shiva, Devi, and Vishnu as well. You get Tantra for all of these, and Jain Tantras as well. So there's that general distinction within Shaivism between the Maheshwaras and the Shaktas. I'm taking initiation. Now, the Shaivas.
The Shaivas are the...
The Maheshwaras. There's that distinction. Puranic worship and non-Puranic worship of Shiva. Not Orthodox worship and non-Orthodox worship of Shiva. Is that okay, everyone, so far? We've got this. And then you've got... So the Shaivas are further subdivided into what was called the Ati Marga and the Mantra Marga. This is Abhinavagupta's classification. Ati Marga means the higher or outer path, and the Mantra Marga is the path of mantras. And the Mantra Marga is the Shaiva word for the tantric revelation. So those who follow the Mantra Marga are following the tantras. The Ati Marga are still following the Vedas, but they are initiates, and the Ati Marga comprise several groups, of which the most important are the Pashupatas, which leads us to the subject of today's lecture. Pashupati is a name for Shiva in the Veda.
The Lord, king of animals.
Yeah, the king of animals. Yeah. The king of the animals. Pashupati, lord of beasts. And the lord of the soul, because the Pashu became a word for the soul. So the Pashu is bound by the Pasha, by the noose. So the Pashupatas, the Pashupatas then were ascetics. They were male Brahmins who had undergone initiation and separated themselves out from the others. So the Ati Marga was the higher path or the outer path, which they thought was the fulfillment of the Veda. This is probably a very early group, going back to the... Perhaps as early as the 2nd century BC, because there's in the Narayaniya section of the Mahabharata, it talks about the Pashupatas. But we don't have any texts of the Pashupatas until we get the Pashupata Sutra of Kaundinya, which is composed about the 2nd or 3rd century CE.
So I'm a bit confused if the ascetics that follow the Vedas, why are they classified under the tantric?
Oh, they're not technically classified under the tantric. That should be a little further over.
Okay.
So the tantras are the Shaivas who are initiated, but they don't follow the tantric. They're proto-tantric, pre-tantric kind of groups. It's only the Mantra Marga that actually follows the tantric revelation.
Okay.
Sorry, which century, roughly?
This is about 2nd or 3rd century AD, Kandinya, the Pashupata Sutra, and it contains information about the Pashupatas. Now, they became a very powerful group in medieval India, and they owned large tracts of land. The Somnath Temple in Gujarat was owned by the Pashupatas before it was sacked by the Lord of Ghazni in 1027, and all that big, they had a massive gold linga in the Somnath Temple, which was parted off by the Lord of Ghazni. Nobody knows where he took it. He probably melted it down or something.
So you're saying that the Tantra, does that lead to the Shaiva or not?
It's
under the Purana, is it?
There are three classes of texts, Veda, Purana and Tantra. And there's Vedic and Puranic worship, and the Atimarga, if you like, is between the Tantra and the Purana.
Oh, it is between, so that's right. Okay.
So they didn't follow the Tantras, the Pashupatas.
No.
But they sort of loosely adhered to the Vedas and Puranas, but they said their revelation was higher than the Vedas or Puranas. And you know the four ashrams, the four stages of life, can you remember what they are?
Ashrams.
Student stage, householder stage,
Vanaprastha,
and
forest dweller.
Forest dweller, and then the sannyasa, the renunciation. They said they had the fifth. The pancha, the fifth ashrama, which was the Pashupata observance. So there are ascetics, they cover themselves in the ashes of cow dung, one of their observances of bathing in cow dung, and they couldn't have any interaction with women, they couldn't speak with women. We had a monk here who couldn't do that one. Years ago, but they really need them. And they followed three stages of their observance, of their vrata. One was temple worship. So they lived in a Shaiva temple, Shivalinga, dancing and singing and repeating five mantras of Shiva. And the second point of their practice was they took off any external symbols of their cult and wandered about. And in the wandering phase of their life, they behaved as if mad. So they pretend to be lame, or they howl like dogs, it says in the Pratipada Sutra, or you make lewd gestures to young women, or you just be a nuisance to everybody. Sounds like an Oxford building site. And then the third phase would be you'd give up that and you'd go back to you'd live in a cremation ground. And you'd just practice your mantras again. Oh, the idea of this antisocial behaviour was so that the good karma of people who abused you would go into you. You would get their good karma through people. If you're a holy man and people are shouting abuse at you, of course you've shouted abuse at them.
So you have to be abused.
Yes, you have to be abused. That's right. You have to be abused. Yes.
So if you're not.
Yes, that practice doesn't work unless people people abuse you. Yeah,
it won't work in England.
It wouldn't.
People just walk
past. We have an audience.
It's no good karma.
That's right. You're so frustrated. What are you doing? You end up with a social worker.
Yes.
The cremation ground ascetics, they repeated these five mantras of Shiva, and you just eventually just died, and they believed that when they died, they would achieve Shiva Rudra Tulya, equality with Rudra. Sorry, not Rudra, Rudra Samudja.
Are these the Aghoris?
No, these are the forerunners of the Aghoris. That was their goal. Rudra I can't spell for this. Samudja. Now, although they're ascetics, male ascetics covering themselves in cremation ground ash, there are various other groups within the Atimurga. The Pashupatas are the most important. But there's a subgroup of the Pashupatas called the Lakunisha. Husada may have been a historical figure, Lakunisha, the lord of the Lakuni, the lord of the club. There's another name for Shiva. And this group were a bit more extreme than the Pashupatas. And they believe that Shiva or Bhairava incarnated into a Brahmin's corpse in the cremation ground and animated it. And this was Lakulisha. And Lakulisha gave these teachings. He was the corpse of a Brahmin animated by Shiva. Now these Lakulishas lived in cremation grounds and they started to cover themselves in the ashes of cremation ground ash, i.e. polluting themselves, consciously going against the Vedic authorities. So the Pashupatas cover themselves in cow dung ash, which was still within orthodoxy, but the cremation ground ash was outside, was beyond the pale of orthodoxy, because you're consciously polluting yourself. And they carried Vanga, a skull-topped staff in imitation of Shiva. Staff with a skull on the top and a skull bowl, begging bowl, cranium begging bowl. In imitation of Shiva. Now, it's a mythology. In the mythology of Shiva, so they're trying to copy, they're imitating Shiva in the myth. There's one of the variants of the myth in the Puranas is that Brahma, the five-headed god Brahma, the creator god, well, there's two versions. One version is that he tries to sexually assault his daughter, who is Shiva's wife, and Shiva gets angry with him and attacks him in the form of Virabhadra and cuts off his head with his thumbnail. And the Brahmin's head sticks to his hand. He can't get rid of it. So he wanders around for 12 years and then it falls. And it falls at the... in the Ghat in Varanasi. The Tirtha. There's a very famous Tirtha. The Kapala Mochana, the freeing of the skull Tirtha in Varanasi, where people bathe and all the rest of it. So that's the mythology behind it. And then also in the laws of Manu, for killing a Brahmin, the penalty is to carry the Brahmin's skull for 12 years as a penance and wander around with the Brahmin's skull that you've killed for 12 years. So that's the myth reflects the Manu injunction. And so these Lakulishas followed that vow, and they called it the Great Vow, Mahavrata. So they wandered around with a skull-topped staff and a skull-begging bowl, imitating their god Shiva in his ferocious form, Bhairava or Virabhadra. And also Shiva as the beggar, Bhikshayatana, was this form of Shiva. Now this group, the Pashupatas and the Lakulishas, in the 7th, 8th, 9th centuries, other groups developed, particularly a group called the Kala Mukhas, the black-faced ones, and the Karpalikas, the famous Karpalikas. Now the word Karpalika in Sanskrit dramas they become figures of fun. They become figures of, like Bhai Jayantabhata talks about them as two Karpalikas in his play, who he lampoons, who he takes the mickey out of. So they become like monsters. It becomes a word for like a monster, an outrageous kind of figure. Because the Karpalika, the Kalamukhas were also, particularly in Andhra Pradesh, were a very powerful sect, and they owned again vast tracts of land. And as you get in all of these monastic traditions, they create great wealth because the ascetics don't buy anything. And then the kings usually go for them. The kings like happened in Henry VIII's time in the Reformation. So these monasteries became subject to attack from kings just to get their wealth. But particularly in Karnataka, the Kalamukkas was very powerful. There's a good book by Lorenzen called The Kalamukkas and Karpalikas. It's quite an old book now, about the 70s, but it's still quite good. And the Karpalikas were again wandering ascetics. I don't think they had the institutional base of the Pashupatis and the Kalamukkas, but they became sort of iconic figures. And you've heard of the untouchables. Well, these were regarded as unseeable. They were so polluted by the Brahmins. And if you saw one, you had to stare into the sun to purify your eyes, if you're Orthodox Brahmin. And it's these kinds of characters that Bhatta Narayana is worried about. And he's worried not particularly about the Kapalikas and so on, but the ideology, the Kapalika ideology, is infiltrating the courts of the king. And that's what he's worried about. That this tantric, extreme tantric ideology, that you can do whatever you like, that liberation is about freeing the self from restriction and inhibition, is a rot creeping into the heart of the social order. So, because the kings are very interested in this, because the kings are into power. The kings want power, siddhi, they want diksha and power. Right, are you okay so far with this? You're not overwhelmed with information, good. Now, by the time you get to the 9th century or so, Abhinavagupta is probably dies about 1050. He's aware of these groups. Now, he's aware that there's... that's the Atimurga. That's a kind of a proto-pre-tantric revelation. Now, there's this other great group of texts starts to develop called the Mantramarga, which Abhinavagupta divides into the Shaiva Siddhanta. And what's called the non-Siddhantika groups, which comprise a number of different traditions. I just call it Kashmir Shaivism now. But I'll put that in inverted commas. Because the Kashmir Shaivism was beyond just Kashmir. It was a kind of Shaivism that pervaded most of the subcontinent in the medieval period. Now, the Shaiva Siddhanta, which still exists today, in the north, in Kashmir, developed particularly in Kashmir, where it became a system of ritual and knowledge. So it was orthodox. So you, let's take a snapshot. You've got the 9th century AD. You've got the Atimurga Pashupatas, who are very powerful, who own vast tracts of land in like Sonar Temple, but are ascetics, a renunciate order. You've got the Shaiva Siddhantins, who adhere to a tantric revelation, part of the Mantramarga, and who are ascetics. They have monasteries, but they're also householders. They have a large householder following. And then you've got these non-Siddhanta groups, which are also ascetics, but are also householders as well. And then you've got the orthodox Brahmanical tradition carrying on of Vedic orthopraxy, Puranic and Vedic orthopraxy.
What does Siddhanta mean?
Siddhanta means the end of the perfected teachings, doctrines of Shiva, Shaiva Siddhanta, teachings and doctrine. In Buddhism, I think it comes to mean Lankavatara Sutra, that Siddhanta means realization. But in the usually it means teaching. So it's a bit like Mahayana Buddhism, this is Shaiva Siddhanta. You can't understand the tantric, you can't understand Tibetan Buddhism or Vajrayana without the Mahayana, so you can't understand the Kashmiri Shaivism without the Shaiva Siddhanta.
So close parallel between those?
Yeah.
Okay.
Close parallel. Now, the
Mahayana Buddhism, you said.
It's a parallel. Yeah. Mahayana Buddhism is like Shaiva Siddhanta. Kashmir Shaivism is like Vajrayana. Let's get rid of the Atimarga now. Now, the Shaiva Siddhanta reveals a group of texts called the Tantras. It's a revelation called the Tantras, which started to develop in the early medieval period. Various groups. Now, the one that I'll give you the name of a couple, the Kirila. That's translated into English by Dominic Goodall, Kirila Tantra, and the Parakya, also translated by Dominic Goodall. Other translation. There are other texts. The earliest one is Nishvasa. That's not translated. And then it moved south, the Shaiva Siddhanta, and it became interfused with Tamil devotionalism, Tamil Bhakti. So the Shaiva Siddhanta in South India today is from this tradition, but it's interfused with Tamil Bhakti, with Bhakti devotion to Shiva. And the Nayanars, the poet saints in the sweet Tamil language, singing songs to Shiva. And if you go to South India today, the Chola Empire and all these big South Indian kingdoms were Shaiva kings, adherents of the Shaiva Siddhanta. And they worship Shiva in the form of a linga in these massive temples. If you go to some of these fantastic places in the south, you really see these.
Well, I'm just wondering, so we're talking about Kashmir and Tamil, they're like other ends of the country. Yeah. What happened in the middle?
There was Shaiva groups were in the middle as well.
Right.
Yeah. But we have records from Kashmir, very particularly developed in Kashmir, and we have records from the south. But there are only inscriptions, I think. There are no texts that we know of. Karnataka, I think, could be groups there. And the Lingayats still exist, and they're a later development of the Kalmukha sect. And the Aghoris in Varanasi today were these extreme kind of tantric creation ground sects.